cost of living crisis. Submissions from 3,000-plus parents who have taken part in an ongoing Child Poverty Action Group survey about the two-child limit found that in the last year, many more families had struggled to pay for power bills and for their food. Individual testimonies from some of those affected include parents missing meals, children unable to join school clubs and outings, and women who feel forced to return to work when their babies are only a few months old. While ministers bill the limit as a fair way to ensure people take financial responsibility for their family decisions, the Child Poverty Action Group said there was no evidence it had affected fertility rates and that it simply pushed huge numbers of children into poverty, something which has been shown to affect long-term life chances. The report said abolishing the limit would cost £1.3 billion a year and would lift 250,000 children out of poverty, with a further 850,000 in less deep poverty. According to the Child Poverty Action Group's calculations, the limit now hits 1.5 million children, 1.1 million of whom are in poverty, with 58% of families affected having someone in work. The group's survey showed that working families affected by the policy, 87% said it made it harder for them to pay for food during 2022-2023, up from 78% a year earlier. The rate for non-working households is 90%. For all affected families, the proportion struggling with their gas and electricity bills rose from 73% to 82%, despite the government's intervention to limit bills. Alison Garnham, the Child Poverty Action Group's chief executive, said 6 years to the day since this nastiest of policies came into effect, our survey is showing its devastating effect. The two-child limit makes it impossible for parents to provide their children with essentials, and the cost-of-living crisis is adding extra pain. Alison Garnham added, the number of children in poverty rose by 350,000 last year, and the two-child limit played a big part in that rise. There is no place for this policy in a country that believes all children deserve a good start. Ministers must remove it before it does more damage to children and to family life in Britain.
The future of Palestine.
Precise technical solutions to make Israelis, Palestinians, and the region safer and much more prosperous.
This deal is not a deal for peace or a peace plan. It is a war plan because this legalized the occupation. This plan legalized the settlements. This plan legalized the annexation of Jerusalem. This plan says no return for the Palestinian refugees.
You know, we are the oppressed and they are the oppressors. And they want the oppressed to give more to the oppressor. They want the oppressed to be oppressed more.
What would you do? You would just leave your houses for money, leave your land, leave your life, your memories, your history for money?
The deal of the century, the Trump so-called peace plan, which the Israelis and the United States of America claim will bring peace to the Middle East. but the Palestinians outright reject and say is an attack on their national identity as well as their land. I'm Robert Inlakesh, and I've come here to occupied Palestine to investigate what the so-called deal of the century means for the Palestinian people and the future of Palestine. Following the official release of the controversial plan proposed to end the Palestine-Israel conflict, an escalation of violence ensued in occupied Palestine as Israeli occupation forces brutally attacked Palestinian demonstrators, only to strengthen the resolve of the Palestinian national resistance. Being on the ground in Palestine, I lived through this round of violence, witnessing vivid scenes of brutality, racist hate crimes, and the murder of Palestinians. But before we investigate this further, we have to first look at the past to understand how things got to where they are today. The peace process between Palestinians and Israelis, as it is often referred to, was officially initiated with the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993. When PLO leader Yasser Arafat signed the agreement with the Israelis, it was supposed to lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state and the ending of hostilities between Palestinians and Israelis. However, a Palestinian state, as well as peace in the Middle East, never came. Instead, the Oslo Accords had meant for the newly established Palestinian Authority that they had accepted an exclusively Jewish ethno-state on 78% of their historic homeland and received nothing in return. 5 years after the signing of the Oslo Accords, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza was even more deeply entrenched as Israeli settlements expanded on Palestinian land. The only difference on the ground, as peace talks had been ongoing, was that there had been further theft of Palestinian West Bank resources, the besiegement of Gaza, and the bombardment of the Gaza Strip. All of this whilst the Palestinian Authority, based in Ramallah, had acted to protect Israeli security interests. Then, following the second Palestinian uprising in 2000, the illegal separation wall was later built in 2002, in the West Bank, usurping approximately 10% of the territory, also collectively punishing 150 Palestinian communities who were disconnected from their lands, according to the human rights group B'Tselem. Settlements continued expanding and the further confiscation of land and resources from Palestinians ensued, with illegal religious extremist Israeli settlers seizing Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem as well as in the West Bank, all of this being justified by the Israeli claim the Palestinian terrorists had to be subdued and Israel's security had to be protected. Now, Donald Trump's self-proclaimed roadmap to peace would essentially allow for Israel to take half of the West Bank, annexing the most fertile agricultural lands, aquifers, and prohibiting Palestinians from having an army or any real autonomy. It would also connect Palestinian Bantustans together via underground tunnels. Upon arriving in occupied Palestine, I had traveled to the village of Kafin near Tulkarm, where an unarmed 19-year-old boy named Badr was shot in the neck and killed by Israeli occupation forces for protesting against the deal of the century. Unfortunately, this was not the last funeral that I attended of young people and children who had been murdered in the West Bank. However, they all resembled each other roughly. Palestinian family members grieving, the look of disbelief on a broken mother's face, and the cries from the village for a day where the martyrdom of their brother or sister will enable a free Jerusalem al-Quds, a belief that gives meaning to the life of those martyred. Al-Quds is at the heart of every Palestinian. It is holy to both Muslim and Christian Palestinians who are currently unable to visit if they live in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, or Palestinian diaspora. The international consensus for a solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict states that East Jerusalem is to be the capital of the future Palestinian state. This, however, is not what is being allocated to the Palestinians under the Trump-Netanyahu vision. Instead, they are confining the capital of the Palestinian people to outside the separation walls of Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
I'm standing here in Abu Dis, the proposed capital for the Palestinian people. And of course, Abu Dis here is a suburb just outside of mainland Jerusalem, Al-Quds. And what we see here in Abu Dis is the apartheid system in the West Bank at its most clearest. We see over here behind us Palestinian villages, Jerusalemites, separated from their brethren and their lands on the other side of the wall over here. People who have been separated so that they cannot see their family members, that they cannot come and farm their lands, and of course separated by this wall. If this was to be accepted as the capital of Palestine, that would mean not only would it be this little slither of land, which would not include the old city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, but it means that it will be a symbol of the oppression of the Palestinian people. And for them to live like this, seeing every single day what could have been, and Jerusalem, Al-Quds, with Masjid al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rocks in the background, is utter pain and struggle.
The separation of Jerusalemite Muslims and Christians from Jerusalem al-Quds is rarely ever shown on mainstream Western television. And so, before you travel to the West Bank, one would imagine that the situation is completely different from the reality faced here. What my cameraman and I witnessed on the Palestinian side of Israel's wall was the humiliation of Palestinians on a daily basis, and a space allocated for a capital which would hardly drive tourism to a country with its depressing scenery, bringing with it a feeling of walking around in an open-air prison. Even on the other side of the wall, Palestinian homes are constantly being demolished and stolen by Israeli settlers, as Donald Trump emboldens their actions with the decree that Israel's undivided capital is to be Jerusalem al-Quds. The justification given by Israel for such disturbing realities imposed on the ground is that what has been imposed is for Israel's security. But even if that was the truth behind the occupation and violations of international law, this excuse was not accepted internationally by the court of public opinion when it came to apartheid South African whites. So why is it reasonable coming from Israeli Jews, I ask? But the issue of division isn't the only problem facing the Palestinians. There is also the problem of where the two divided peoples would live if remaining segregated, and where any viable borders could possibly exist between Palestinians and the Israelis. The issues of borders is of course made tough due to the Israeli illegal racial colonies, or settlements as they're referred to.
Something that you cannot escape when you come here to the West Bank is seeing and witnessing how deeply entrenched these settlements are into the Palestinian land here.
Currently, over 750,000 illegal Israeli settlers live on stolen Palestinian land, equating to a land grab of 40% of the West Bank. Due to seizure of land, Palestinians currently live in 165 disconnected islands surrounded by checkpoints, military outposts, closed military zones, and settlements. What is perhaps more disturbing, however, is the fact that one of the chief architects of what is supposed to be a peace deal, Jared Kushner, has direct ties to the funding of an illegal settlement named Beit El, with almost $100,000 that we know about. Kushner is also an open supporter of illegal settlements. Understanding that under Trump's so-called peace plan, settlements will remain in place, I traveled to occupied Al-Khalil, or Hebron as it's called, to meet with local human rights activist Isa Amro to learn more about what the situation would remain as in the heart of the illegal settler conflict zone.
Trump's plan
is to make this permanent. Trump's plan is about, you know, legitimizing the settlements and legitimizing this apartheid and segregation and separation and keep me without any basic human rights. We are allowed to film. He's illegal. Because they don't want us to film their weakness and their truth. They don't want us to expose that Israel is an apartheid state, Israel is not a democracy, and Israel is not a state of law. It's the state of settlers, soldiers, and it's the state of apartheid and segregation.
This is my home.
It's not your home.
This is my country.
It's not your country. Okay, that is the truth here.
Yes.
So the street is closed, all the shops are closed by military orders, and marked as closed shops. Look, it's marked, sealed, welded as closed shop. It was closed first 1994 after the Ibrahim Moss massacre.
And what justification do they give? Why do they say they have to be closed? Do they give you a justification for closing it?
Always, always. The false justification is security. The main reason for it, it's about confiscation and to have the Arab free zone here. Closing the city center. It's the hub of the city, you know. It's the heart of the city. They closed it and they control it and they drive here. We are not allowed to drive. We are not allowed to drive in our own streets. Our shops are closed. Our houses became empty. They changed the names of the streets from Palestinian Arabic name to Israeli Hebrew names. The road signs are only in English and Hebrew. Israeli flags here. They are taking our identity as Palestinian identity.
And this system right here with the shops closed and everything happening, under Trump's plan, this would remain closed?
It will remain closed. They didn't touch it. They don't talk about it. The main entrance to the family is closed. Yes. The main road is closed. And we are using the fields to reach the house here. And the family is separated and isolated alone. And the army is occupying the roof. They have a military post on the roof. The family is not allowed to go to the roof.
Yeah.
And they are locked inside the house. And from time to time, the settlers come to the roof, throw stones, throw rocks, throw rubbish to the family without any help. Not only that, the Palestinian ambulance is not allowed to reach here without a special coordination. So you skip all the emergency cases. So you are not only sieged by the army and the soldiers, you are sieged from any kind of basic human rights.
We continued to film until we reached a military outpost, where we were at first instructed at gunpoint to go back because Palestinians could not walk on the Jewish-only street there. So we filmed secretly as I asked the soldier present why Aysa and my cameraman Hamdi were not able to walk on the road.
So, if it belongs only to Jews, then is this not racism?
This is illegal settlements under international law. They take this. Why not one person, one vote? Why not equal rights? Because this here is like in apartheid South Africa. If you went to apartheid South Africa, you would see the same thing. And so this is racism. And racism doesn't change depending upon where you go because of security situation. It's racism. That's it.
I understand what you're saying, but yesterday, the day before, they were trying to stab people in the...
Stab, but you shoot. And you arrest children.
It doesn't matter.
But does that justify hurting them, killing them?
I don't
occupying
help.
Them?
Nobody helped.
The soldier I just engaged with refused to speak to me until I told him I was not a Palestinian. But many other soldiers had an even more negative attitude towards us, making it clear that Palestinians or any friends of Palestinians were not welcome. After witnessing the situation in El Khalil, I then traveled to Ramallah in order to take part in protests rejecting the deal of the century. At this protest you're seeing alone, tens of protesters were shot and many others gassed, causing them to collapse and convulse.
We have an attack here on a member of the press, clearly marked as press. It's of course a violation of international law, firing tear gas everywhere. He passed out unconscious. This man is marked as a press and of course is not protesting. He's here to document purely, and he was targeted by the Israelis.
After the demonstration, we found out following a visit to the Ramallah hospital that four young boys were shot with internationally banned bullets. Three were hit in the legs and one in the head. The protests I witnessed, however, were just the tip of the iceberg. Other demonstrations were much more violent and led to the deaths of several young Palestinians. to find out more about why Palestinian people broke out into mass protest against the deal of the century, I met with the world-renowned journalist Jana Jihad and Palestinian icon Ahed Tamimi, both locals to the village of Nabi Saleh.
So since the announcement of the so-called
first asking Jana what she had witnessed since the announcement of the Trump plan.
As you said, are getting killed, people are getting arrested. I'm facing checkpoints on my way to school every day. Like, for example, yesterday, I was just going to my school and then there was this checkpoint. You know, the checkpoints here in the West Bank are not checkpoints. They're just a gate on the street. They usually close it, block the street, and then they go. They don't check the car, they just block it. So, like, I had to take another way that takes me about triple the time to get to my school. I was late to my school. Even today, we were stuck for 2 hours on the checkpoint. Every day since the deal of the century had been declared, you know, people, there are a lot of clashes, people are getting killed, people are getting injured, and it's very sad that we are paying the price of something that we didn't cause.
What we heard from Donald Trump was that when this deal was initially announced, that there would be some sort of peace that would come out of this and that the Palestinians would receive a great amount of money.
I believe that legalizing what's illegal is not peace. Legalizing occupation, legalizing settlements, it's not what we call peace. And I don't care about money. I just want my land. I want to stay in my house. I want to go to the sea that I've never been to, which is only 30 minutes far from my house, that I can literally see every single morning from the roof of my house that I've never been to. That's what I call peace, but that's not peace. And I don't care about money. What if I came and told you I want half of America? I'd pay you, but I just want half of America. Like, what would you do? You would just leave your houses for money, leave your land, leave your life, your memories, your history for money?
In Ramallah, I witnessed the largest demonstration the city had seen since the time of the Second Intifada, or uprising as it is known in English. What was clear to me in the West Bank was that there was a growing sense of desperation and also unity from the Palestinian people that could be felt building day by day. The desperation for action coming from the threat immediately posed to annex areas such as the Jordan Valley, which is where I began to travel to next.
So we've just entered the Jordan Valley here, and what we witnessed just as we were entering was the closed military zones here and the soldiers in the fields actually aiming just above children and telling them to duck, using them sort of as firing practice. And then what we also discovered as we were driving along is that two Bedouin children, young children who were riding on donkeys, were also arrested by the army.
The Jordan Valley is home to 70,000 Palestinians, yet is 85% inaccessible to its people as Israel has turned the land into a military training ground and allowed for illegal settlers to come in and make goods to sell around the world. The area is under international law recognized as Palestinian land, which is to be the future agricultural hub of Palestine. Its undeveloped areas could also be used for energy projects, water extraction, and urban centers.
One of the most important things to understand about the Jordan Valley is that this land here constitutes 30% of the West Bank, and of course means the loss of the most fertile agricultural land for a potential future Palestinian state. What you can see straight away when you come here to the Jordan Valley is that the people primarily here are building their houses as tents and as sort of cave structures and things like this, because the Israelis don't allow them here in Area C to actually build, have the permits to build homes. So if they were to actually build proper homes already before the land being annexed, and of course these people inevitably being expelled, then their homes would be bulldozed.
The conditions that have been imposed in the plan says that there is no Palestinian state. So what will happen with us? We are here more than 50% of the population. Now every year they demolish about 500 houses there. This plan says no Palestinian state and no sovereignty, no borders, no water, no air, no underground, nothing for the Palestinians. In Jordan Valley we are 70,000 Palestinians, and and the Israeli settlers are only 8,000. So we have to stay, and our existence there will be the main factor to stop the century plan.
It was clear from even before U.S. President Donald Trump, alongside Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, announced the details of the plan, that the Israeli regime sought to annex the Jordan Valley, northern Dead Sea, and illegal settlements, throwing away all the progress of work done since 1988 between Palestinians and Israelis. Looking on at the situation on the ground in Palestine, it was clear that a two-state solution looked impossible, and that a one-state solution where Palestinians could live with equal rights to Israelis was a long way from coming to fruition. However, the younger generation of Palestinians served as a great source of hope that one day liberation could perhaps be in sight, and that the failure of the old is now being replaced by a new vision for peace coming from the young.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Beijing and its partners reportedly hope to challenge the U.S. dominance of the global communications infrastructure. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Reuters reported, China's largest telecom firms are working on a massive undersea telecommunications cable network aimed at challenging the U.S. dominance in operating global internet infrastructure. Four people involved with the project told Reuters recently. China Telecom, China Mobile Limited, and China Unicom are in the planning stages of what is expected to be a $500 million undersea fiber optic project connecting Asia with the West Asia and Europe, the sources said. The sprawling network known as EMA, Europe, Middle East, Asia, is reportedly intended to compete with another cable system currently under construction by U.S. firm Subcom LLC called CMEWE6, that is Southeast Asia, Middle East, Western Europe 6. Chinese firm HMN Tech, formerly Huawei Marine Networks, was initially selected in 2020 to manufacture the cable for CMEWE6 by a consortium that included the Chinese telecoms now working on EMA. However, a sustained U.S. pressure campaign that included millions of dollars in training grants to foreign telecoms in return for switching their votes ultimately pushed the contract to HMN's U.S. competitor last year, despite significantly higher costs. The three Chinese telecoms have reportedly signed agreements with telecoms in France, Pakistan, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, with further deals in the works elsewhere in Asia, Africa and the West Asia region. The consortium hopes to bring EMA online by the end of 2025, the sources told Reuters. The advantages of such a project for China are obvious. One source told Reuters, a faster connection between China, Hong Kong and the rest of the world not under U.S. control gives Beijing an insurance policy should they be cut off from U.S.-controlled networks. Washington has been campaigning for years to convince allies to exclude Chinese companies from future infrastructure projects. However, Reuters sources said they fear the plan presages a growing division of global internet infrastructure into what a researcher for military industrial think tank RAND Corporation described as a U.S.-led internet and a Chinese-led internet ecosystem. The more the U.S. and Chinese disengage from each other in the information technology domain, the more difficult it becomes to carry out global commerce and basic functions, RAND's Timothy Hitt told Reuters, warning that forcing third countries to choose between the two sides would make technologies like GPS satellites and online banking much less reliable. Also, according to Eurasian Times, the undersea cables, which carry the vast majority of the world's internet traffic, have become a key point of connection between the two global superpowers, as intelligence agencies can tap into the cables to carry out surveillance. Over 400 undersea cables carry over 95% of all international internet traffic globally, according to data from Telegeography, a Washington-based telecommunications research firm, as quoted by various reports. These data conduits, which transmit everything from emails and banking transactions to military secrets, are vulnerable to sabotage, attacks, and espionage, Reuters claimed, quoting an unnamed U.S. administration official and two security analysts. The undersea cables have become a new front in the ongoing U.S.-China tech war, became evident in February when two communications cables connecting Taiwan with its Matsu Islands were caught, disconnecting the 14,000 residents' internet, report said on March 8.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن ملکون
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance
Spring of truth
Allah ya Allah subhan Allah ya Allah walhamdulillah
Imam Khomeini's speech on the holy month of Ramadan. God willing, God will help you in performing all worldly and religious duties and will diminish your pains for the next day. If you repeat this many times, it is imminent that you will be accustomed to the acts of piety. You will see then that all this does not require you to make hard efforts. You will also notice that obedience to Allah gives ample pleasure. Though this world is not where one is immediately rewarded, yet faithfulness to Allah and abstaining from sins is fruitful in this world also. God never entrusts his creatures with cumbersome and heavy tasks, which are beyond their power, but it is the Satan and his allies who magnify them in your view. God forbid, if there are any lapses on your part, ask Allah's forgiveness and beseechingly implore him that you will be more careful in future so that the Almighty may throw open the doors of his grace and compassion to you and may guide you in the straight path.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Welcome to the Spring of the Truth from IRB English Radio. In a statement from Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about the importance of the holy month of Ramadan, he says, the most important thing is for a person to reform himself in the month of Ramadan. We need to reform. We need to refine our souls. Until the end of our life, we are in need of this reform and this refinement. The great prophets of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala are also in need of that. But we could not understand it because we are covered with a hijab, with a covering. And this hijab and covering comes from a lack of fulfillment of our obligations. Imam rahmatullah continues and says that, I hope that this holy month of Ramadan will be blessed for all of you, God willing. And being blessed in this month means that you allow yourself to fulfill the duties of God. As an Islamic leader, Imam rahmatullah alayhi tells the people that try to work on yourself in this month, in this holy month. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi. He emphasizes on purification of the self and the refinement of the self and to reform oneself. This can be exactly compared to what we have in hadith that says, Man arafa nafsa, faqad arafa rabba. That is, anyone who has understood himself, everyone who has worked in himself, he has understood his God. So let's pray Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us this chance and tawfiq to work on ourselves in this holy month of Ramadan and to be cautious of what we are doing in this month. Kind of action, the kind of, let's say, observation that was even observed by the great prophets of God. So we as ordinary human beings are more in need of such refinement and such purification. So we need to work on ourselves to remove these obstacles, to remove these hijab and coverings, to know what our duties are and to fulfill our duties and to act upon what has been put in our shoulder. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
International Monetary Fund, IMF, has warned that the world economy is facing its weakest period of growth since 1990s in the next 5 years due to problems triggered by the pandemic and political tensions around the world. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Bloomberg, the International Monetary Fund has warned that its outlook for global economic growth over the next 5 years is the weakest in more than 3 decades, urging nations to avoid economic fragmentation caused by geopolitical tension and take steps to bolster productivity. The emergency lender sees the world economy expanding about 3% over the next half decade as higher interest rate bite, managing director Kristalina Georgieva said in a speech in Washington recently. That's the lowest medium-term growth forecast since 1990 and less than the 5-year average of 3.8% from the past 2 decades. For 2023, global gross domestic product, GDP, will likely expand by less than 3%, she said. That's in line with the fund's January forecast of 2.9%. About 90% of advanced economies will see growth slow this year, as tighter monetary policy weighs on demand and slows economic activity in the U.S. and euro area, the IMF said. It plans to release a more detailed World Economic Outlook report on April 11th as part of its spring meetings held together with the World Bank. Georgieva said in a Bloomberg television interview with Tom Kinn, the world economy as a whole is now less able to support the weakest members. Why? The peace dividend is gone. Some emerging markets are showing strength, particularly in Asia, with India and China expected to account for half of global expansion. But low-income nations are hamstrung by weakening demand for their exports, with their per capita income growth remaining below that of the emerging economies. Poverty and hunger that increased during the coronavirus pandemic could climb. Despite the bleak growth outlook, high inflation means that central banks must continue to raise interest rates as long as financial stability pressures remain limited. After recent banking industry upheaval in the U.S. and Switzerland, Georgieva said, if the banking system becomes unstable, policymakers will face more complicated trade-offs between inflation and the safeguarding the financial system, Georgieva added. Be vigilant and more agile than ever. Policymakers are set to converge in Washington for sessions focused on numerous global challenges, from unsustainable debt in developing nations to inflation to climate change. Georgieva said in her speech, with rising geopolitical tensions, with inflation still running high, a robust recovery remains elusive. That harms the prospects of everyone, especially for the most vulnerable people and most vulnerable countries. Georgieva's stark message comes a day after the IMF warned that geopolitical fragmentation driven by tensions between the U.S. and China risks damaging the global economy, with foreign direct investment and other capital increasingly being channeled toward aligned blocs of countries. She repeated a warning from January that longer-term trade fragmentation, including restrictions on migration, capital flows, and international cooperation, could cut global gross domestic product by as much as 7%. 7%, equivalent to the combined annual output of Germany and Japan, or about $7 trillion. Interruptions to technology trade could see losses as large as 12% of GDP for some countries, Georgieva said. She said in the television interview, "Getting on a path of less fragmentation in the world economy is good for everybody." Meanwhile, RT noted, the world economy is facing its weakest period of growth since 1990s in the next 5 years due to problems triggered by the pandemic and political tensions. A severe slowdown in the global economy last year following the COVID-19 pandemic and the conflict in Ukraine is set to continue in 2023 and could persist for the next 5 years, Georgieva warned. Global GDP will grow at about 3% over the next half decade compared to an average of 3.8% seen in the past 20 years, representing the worst economic performance in more than three decades. The IMF expects global GDP to expand by less than 3% this year, which is in line with its January projection of 2.9%. Last year, global growth almost halved following an initial post-pandemic rebound in 2021, sliding from 6.1% to 3.4%, Georgieva said, ahead of the IMF World Economic Outlook report, which is due to be released very soon in the future. Up to 90% of advanced economies are likely to experience a decline in their growth rate this year, she warned, with activity in the US and the Eurozone hit by higher interest rates. Georgieva said, with rising geopolitical tensions, with inflation still running high, a robust recovery remains elusive. That harms the prospects of everyone, especially for the most vulnerable people and most vulnerable countries. The IMF head warned against economic fragmentation stemming from geopolitical tensions and urged countries to take action to boost global productivity. According to IMF, soaring inflation facing most of the world's wealthy nations will force central banks to continue interest rate hikes, adding pressure to the banking industry despite financial uncertainty following recent turmoil with lenders in the US and Switzerland. She urged the world community to be vigilant, more agile than ever, adding that regulators may come across more complicated choices to protect the financial system amid persistent inflation and challenges in the banking sector. Long-term disintegration in global trade, such as restrictions on capital flows and international cooperation, as well as curbs on migration, could slash global GDP by up to 7% or $7 trillion, which is the equivalent of the combined annual production of Germany and Japan, IMF warned.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program that takes you on a journey through Africa. We cover wide-ranging current affairs in the continent and also highlight various aspects of the continent's rich history, culture, and civilization. In our program today, we are focusing on how African nations are resisting increasing attempts by the Israeli regime to infiltrate the continent. Governments in Africa particularly through the African Union, are now joining the masses in rejecting the Israeli apartheid regime, which continues to occupy Palestine and commit atrocities against Palestinians. So stay with us.
Africa resisting Israeli apartheid regime. At the opening ceremony of the African Union's annual summit, held at its headquarters in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia last February, the Israeli apartheid regime faced a nasty surprise and total humiliation. The deputy director of the Africa division of the regime's foreign ministry was ejected after gate crashing at the summit.
This ejection of the Israeli diplomat from the African Union summit is indicative of how Africa is resisting brazen attempts by the Israeli regime to infiltrate the continent and meddle in its internal affairs. Speaking after the fiasco, African Union Commission Chairman Moussa Faki Mahamat told reporters in very simple terms that the Israeli diplomat was not invited and was therefore asked to leave the hall.
That somebody entered the hall with a badge. We asked the individual to quickly leave the hall.
On demandait de quitter le lieu.
And now to discuss how African countries are resisting the Israeli apartheid regime, we contacted Bukangesa, a member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement. We're also joined by Zakir Ahmed Mait, a lawyer, activist, and political analyst. Gentlemen, welcome to the program, and let's start off with Mr. Ngesa. Now, despite being suspended by the African Union, the Israeli regime sent a delegation which was ejected from the AU summit last February. Now, why is the regime adamant on imposing itself on African countries?
The Israel apartheid regime is not just an anti-Palestine. It is also a very racist regime. And in fact, their policy towards African continent has been a policy of outright bribery and disrespect to the African people. In fact, even if you look at the way their observer mission was being admitted to the AU, it was a unilateral decision by the chair of the AU. So for them to refuse even to accept their suspension and arrogantly send their representative there to be humiliated, I think they deserved even more humiliation. After all, what is more humiliation than the continued butchering of the Palestinian women and children, and even breaking all the international laws? I think the apartheid regime in Israel that has occupied Palestine has even no moral authority to question any African country about that humiliation, because the administration in that is run by the Zionists under the government of now the current, crisis, Netanyahu, the butcher of the Palestinian people, they break all the international laws. And even in Africa, they don't respect the way the majority of the African people think.
The African Union insists that the Israeli regime's observer status at the 55-nation bloc has been suspended. Many African nations view Israel as a colonizer that does not deserve to be an observer member of the African Union. South African Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Naledi Pandor, says the unjust actions committed by Israel are contrary to the letter and spirit of the African Union.
The unjust actions committed by Israel offend the letter and spirit, as we have pointed out, of the Charter of the African Union. The African Union embodies the aspirations of all Africans and reflects their confidence that it can lead the continent through the practical expression of the goals of the Charter, especially on issues related to self-determination and decolonization. I don't know which African Union state would ever accept its territory being occupied by another country. The support the chairperson has expressed for Israel as an observer status in our union suggests, if we accept this as AU, that we accept infringement of our country's territorial integrity. This can never be accepted by us.
The decision to continue resisting the Israeli regime's attempts to infiltrate African countries is significant and points to the assertiveness of Africans in supporting the liberation of Palestine.
The leaders or the presidents that make decisions at the African Union has been blamed for many times for having sided with them, the apartheid Israel. But at this moment, when that decision was passed, I think African Union continued to redeem its image among the majority of the Kenyan people, the African people. And we can see that not just a few countries, but the majority of the African people supports the decision to suspend the apartheid Israel and, of course, its representation being forced upon the African Union.
The Zionist regime blamed Iran, Algeria, and South Africa for the expulsion of its diplomat from the African Union summit. Now, the regime claimed that the African Union has been taken hostage by these countries. Let's bring in Mr. Zakir Ahmed. Now, what's your take on these condescending and patronizing statement by the Israeli apartheid regime?
Most definitely it is an insult. It's an insult when a colonial settler power, such as the Zionist regime, starts leveling these accusations that it is being dominated and controlled by countries that are African. South Africa and Algeria and many other African countries do not need to be told by other powers what the writing is on the wall. The writing is very clear that Israel is an apartheid state, and South Africa in itself would know better than most. Now, if we look at the evidence is quite clear. This is not something that is dictated to by the Islamic Republic of Iran or any other country. It's what Israel's own organization, such as Beth Salem, is saying. It's a regime of Jewish supremacy. If you go further, Human Rights Watch says a threshold crossed. Now, this is important when you cross-check it with Ehud Barak, defense minister. He had senior positions within the Zionist administration in 2017. He said at the time that we are traveling towards a slippery slope towards apartheid. His opinion at the time was that it was not apartheid. However, when you cross-check it against the Human Rights Watch title, it says threshold crossed. This is exactly what Ehud himself had spoken about. So even from the most hardline officials, from senior officials, you have this acknowledgement that Israel is an apartheid state. Then you look at Amnesty International, cruel system of domination. That's the title of their report.
The African Union recently recommended the boycott of Israeli apartheid and urged member states to end all direct and indirect trade, scientific and cultural exchanges with Israel. Palestinian Authority Prime Minister addressed the February African Union summit and thanked African countries for taking action to back the liberation of Palestine.
It's a message from Africa that it's with the rights of the Palestinian people which cannot be modified.
If the recommendation to boycott Israel is successfully implemented, it will drastically change the apartheid regime's fortunes in Africa and indeed across the globe.
Remember, the apartheid South Africa, led by the Botha regime at that time and the white minority, mainly the Daesh nationalists, they were able to brutalize the South African people. But in the final analysis, the apartheid regime was actually isolated from the rest of the world, and that led to its inevitable fall, even though militarily through the victory of Quito Carnaval.
Algeria has warned that the Israeli regime's attempt to impose itself on the African Union may jeopardize the solidarity that must exist between member states. Now, do you think the Israeli apartheid regime is pursuing the divide and conquer strategy in its attempt to infiltrate Africa?
The last few decades, the Israel regime has continued to trivialize the question of the Palestinian people through telling the African people that this question is about religion. But They're saying that a war between Christians and, you know, our Muslim brothers and sisters. But this war, this current propaganda has been debunked in the last decade.